the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis submitted its final report this month, offering 56 recommendations to the federal government on how to address the drug addiction and opioid crisis. Deaths by drug overdose in the U.S. surged last year by more than 17% over 2015. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it's another sign of the growing addiction crisis caused by opioids. Dr. Andrew Kolodny is the co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. He's also executive director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. He focuses on the prescription opioid and heroin crisis affecting communities and families nationwide. Dr. Kolodny, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this Opioid Commission releases a report, dozens of recommendations. What stands out to you?
Well, there are some good recommendations in the report. I also think that the report did a very nice job of describing the factors that led to the opioid addiction epidemic. For example, the report did a nice job of describing the multifaceted campaign that had been launched by opioid manufacturers to increase prescribing, and explained how that increase in prescribing led to where we are today. Some of the recommendations in the report that I think are pretty good is the report recommends mandatory informed consent. And what I mean by that is they're recommending that when a clinician is prescribing an opioid, that they should be required to warn the patient, or in the case of a child receiving the prescription, the parent, about the risk of addiction to opioids and the risk of becoming dependent. Even if you don't clearly become addicted, it can be hard to come off. And I think that's a really important recommendation, not simply because it means that patients would be better informed and be better able to participate in their decision-making about taking an addictive drug, but I think it is required because many prescribers don't recognize how addictive these drugs are. And I think it's also important because if prescribers are required to have a patient sign a consent form, then I think there is a good chance that prescribers would be less casual in the way they're using these drugs. If it's a little more work to prescribe an opioid, I think that they would be more likely to recommend alternatives to opioids.
And it requires then a mandatory conversation about just how deadly these can be.
Correct. That's right. And again, if prescribers had a good understanding of the risks and benefits of these medicines, we wouldn't need to require them to have this conversation with the patient. But many prescribers are underestimating how addictive these drugs are and overestimating how helpful they can be.
Lots of hand-holding here for prescribers, very prescriptive, if you will, means to getting opioids into the hands of patients. Is this necessary that the prescribers need this much oversight?
I'm afraid they do. I think this is how we got into this mess. You know, I think that for many years there was a tendency to think about our opioid crisis as being about bad apples, that there were a few doctors out there who were really drug dealers running pill mills, and there were some people out there pretending to be patients who were drug abusers, and that, you know, we should try and stop these bad apples, but that the epidemic had nothing to do with well-meaning doctors and dentists and legitimate patients. That's totally not true. The epidemic really has been fueled by well-meaning doctors and dentists over-prescribing. When they get patients addicted, they create customers for the pill mill doctors, but the pill mill doctors are really profiteering off of an epidemic that's been caused by a change in medical practice.
We're with Dr. Andrew Kolodny. He's the co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. He's also head of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. We're discussing a commission's report on recommendations to the federal government on how to address the opioid crisis, drug addiction. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. How has the opioid epidemic touched your life? Do you know someone who has died, or did you conquer the addiction yourself? Join in this conversation, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Kolodny, did the commission discover or unveil any real paths forward for eradicating the epidemic, or can we eradicate it at all?
So the report offers some recommendations, some of which are helpful, like the one I mentioned, others not so much. But it's a report with recommendations. It's not a plan for tackling this problem, and we still don't have a plan. What we need from the Trump administration is for the agencies that have a piece of this problem to put out a report indicating what they intend to do and for there to be immediate action on that plan. We still have no plan, and what we're also missing is a request from the Trump administration to Congress for money to tackle the problem. I think that we need a very large investment in building out a treatment system that doesn't exist yet. If you want to think about ways of ending our opioid addiction epidemic, the strategies are very similar to the strategies we would use for ending infectious disease outbreaks. There are really two things that have to happen to bring our opioid addiction epidemic. And they're really the same two things that would have to happen if you were responding to an Ebola outbreak or a measles outbreak. The way you bring epidemics to an end is by accomplishing two things. You have to prevent more people from getting the disease. In other words, you contain it, so there are less new people in the case of an infectious disease getting infected. In the case of an addiction epidemic, less new people becoming addicted. So number one is prevent new cases. And the other thing that you have to do is see that for the many people who have become addicted, that they can access effective treatment. We're failing on both fronts. We're failing to prevent new cases of opioid addiction, and we're failing to see that people who are addicted can access effective treatment. The way you prevent people from becoming opioid addicted, it's not lecturing to school kids, don't use drugs, or just say no. That's not the way we're going to prevent opioid addiction. The strategies for preventing opioid addiction really boil down to much more cautious prescribing so that we don't directly addict patients and so that we don't indirectly cause addiction by stocking everybody's household with a highly addictive drug. So really much more cautious prescribing is necessary, and we're still massively overprescribing opioids in the U.S. And then when it comes to treatment, the most effective treatment for opioid addiction, or I'd say the first-line treatment for opioid addiction, is with a medicine called buprenorphine, another name for it is Suboxone. And we do not have adequate access to that medicine in the United States. There aren't enough doctors who prescribe it, and it's very hard for patients to find doctors who take their insurance that will treat them with it. So we have to build out a system that doesn't exist yet if we want to see overdose deaths start to come down.
What agencies can work to contain this, can work to solve this problem? What are the target agencies here?
Well, there's a lot that needs to be done on a state level, and there's a role for healthcare systems and for doctors and professional societies. But you know, when we talk about the role that the federal government can play, there's a very important role both in preventing opioid addiction and in treating opioid addiction, which, again, are the things that have to happen to end the epidemic. So what we would want to see in particular would be actions from the Food and Drug Administration to better regulate the way opioids are being marketed and promoted. Opioids are very good medicines for treating pain at the end of life. And they play an important role when used for a couple of days after major surgery or a serious accident. But there isn't much money for a pharmaceutical company to make if opioids are just used for those indications. You know, end-of-life cancer pain is not a very common condition, and patients won't be on your medicine for very long if they're at the end of life. the way pharmaceutical companies can do well with any medication is if they can get the medical community to prescribe it for common chronic conditions. And so opioids have been aggressively marketed over the past 20 years for conditions like low back pain or chronic headache. Another one is fibromyalgia. These are conditions where there's a medical consensus that we shouldn't use opioids, and yet they account for the bulk of the consumption of opioids in the U.S. So the Food and Drug Administration, if it had been properly enforcing existing laws, we would not have opioids marketed for those conditions, because right now there's a law that says that we should only let drug companies promote opioids or promote medicines, whatever the medicine is, for a condition where it's been proven safe and effective, or for conditions where the benefits outweigh the risks. With opioids, that law hasn't been enforced, and we're allowing them to be promoted for conditions where the risks outweigh the benefits. What we should also see from the federal government is funding for the states to build out a treatment system. So we have many states and counties and communities that are doing everything they can to try and control the opioid crisis. Many counties have a task force with participation from the medical community, from law enforcement, from community groups. And some of these task forces are doing terrific work, for example, expanding access to naloxone, which is an antidote for an overdose. And despite much of the hard work that's being done on the local level, the epidemic is still getting worse. What we really have not had happen yet is some help from the federal government. And it's not just the Trump administration. President Obama really did neglect the opioid addiction epidemic until his last year in office. The epidemic began 20 years ago. It was already severe when President Obama took office. And yet it wasn't until his last year in office that he sought funding for the problem or began speaking about it.
Dr. Kolodny, going back to the FDA for a moment, the advisory committee to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, it voted 18-1 that the injectable drug known as RBP-6000 could benefit addicts, and the FDA is due to make a decision on the medicine by November 30th. What do we know about this drug?
Well, it's a version of a medicine. It is buprenorphine in a different form, and buprenorphine is an effective treatment for opioid addiction that generally is available as a sublingual drug. You put it in the mouth, and it dissolves, and it's absorbed through the lining of your mouth. And this is a formulation where a patient can get an injection on a monthly basis and not have to remember to take the drug. And that is helpful, because if patients stop taking their buprenorphine, they're at high risk of relapsing. So it's nice to have another tool out there, and hopefully, you know, the data is good and this will be as effective as the sublingual version of the drug. Just to clarify something, though, because you had mentioned that this is a medicine for addicts. You know, I don't really believe there is such a thing as an addict. What we're dealing with is an epidemic of opioid addiction. There are millions of Americans now suffering from the condition of opioid addiction. The term addict is not just stigmatizing in the same way, you know, calling someone with schizophrenia a schizophrenic would be, because you're defining someone by their illness. The term addict is also misleading, because I think it suggests that, you know, we've got people out there that are using drugs to get high, and or a subset of our population are addicts. They want to use drugs and they behave badly, and, you know, maybe they've inherited it and we've got to try and do something about addicts. But there really is no such thing as an addict. Almost anyone can become addicted to opioids. And it's true that some people became addicted because they were using opioids recreationally. They were enjoying the effect, and that's how they got hooked. But many people have become addicted taking opioids as prescribed by doctors. And once somebody becomes addicted, once they're hooked, they're certainly not doing this because it's fun. Once you're addicted, you have to keep doing it to avoid feeling awful. And so I think we should try to avoid using the term addict. I'm glad that you used it because it gave me an opportunity to explain this.
Drug overdoses have become the leading cause of death for Americans younger than 50, according to the CDC's Mortality Statistics Branch. In recent years, these deaths have been driven by overdoses of synthetic opioids, mostly fentanyl rather than heroin. President Trump has declared the opioid crisis a public health emergency, but has not released additional funding to address it. Dr. Andrew Kolodny stays with us. He is the co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. He also heads up Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. You can join in to this discussion. How has the opioid epidemic touched your life? What should America do to curb the devastating effects of opioid abuse? Is this the government's problem? 800-642-1234. We'll return in just a moment. We're continuing our conversation about America's opioid crisis with Dr. Andrew Kolodny. He's the co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. He also heads up Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. And we're going to go directly now to the phones with Sharon in Waukesha. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking that call. Dr. Kolodny, I greatly appreciate your comments about using the term addict or person with a substance use disorder. I am the mother of someone who had about a 10-year battle with opiates, and he is 5 years into his recovery. Okay. And I have my son back. But additionally, in Waukesha County, I work with a family support group, and so I out of the Addiction Resource Council, and I see these stories all the time. And I just had two comments I wanted to make. One was I wanted you to touch on the pharmaceutical industry's role in all of this. I know you made some comments and you kind of addressed it, but it was kind of in a more passive way, like they're not going to make money if they can't market throughout the lifetime of an individual. And I'm just recently, what's coming to mind is the 60 Minutes episode where a lot of people from the DEA left the DEA and joined the pharmaceutical lobby and then completely hamstringed the DEA in being able to shut down pill factories. So that's my first question. I'd just like you to comment on that kind of issue with the pharmaceutical industry's role. And I know you can't beat them up, but they're a very powerful lobby.
And Sharon, really quickly, the second piece of this?
The second piece of this has to do with incarceration. We can't keep jailing people with substance abuse issues, giving them 18 months in prison or in jail and expecting them to come out clean and over their issue. And I know he can, Dr. Kolodny, can talk to the medical issue attached to that. There is a belief among a lot of families that if my kid ends up in jail or my loved one ends up in jail, they're going to come out and they're going to be fine because they've been away from the drug for 18 months.
Go ahead, Dr. Kolodny.
So I appreciate both questions. The reason we have an epidemic of opioid addiction is because we've overexposed the United States population to a highly addictive drug. It was as prescriptions for opioids began increasing in the mid-90s up until peaking in around 2012 at an extremely high level. As the prescribing went up, rates of addiction and overdose deaths went right up along with the increase in prescribing. So this is an epidemic of opioid addiction caused by aggressive prescribing of a highly addictive drug. The reason that the medical community started to prescribe opioids so aggressively is that we were responding to a brilliant marketing campaign that had been launched initially by one pharmaceutical company, Purdue Pharma, when it introduced OxyContin in 1996, was the first year it hit the market. Ultimately, other opioid manufacturers would become part of this campaign. But when Purdue introduced OxyContin, it was eager to see the medication prescribed widely. It wanted its new extended-release oxycodone product to be used for more than just cancer pain. And so it launched a multifaceted campaign. And if you could go back to the early 90s, before the introduction of OxyContin, that was a time when the medical community understood that opioids were not good drugs for problems like low back pain and chronic headache. We understood that if you put patients long-term on a highly addictive drug, many would get addicted. We understood that tolerance to the pain-relieving effect would mean that doses would have to keep getting higher and higher for the patient to continue to get pain relief. And we understood that it would be hard to get patients off, even if they didn't clearly become addicted. So we had been much more cautious. The campaign that was launched by opioid manufacturers, it was through that campaign that the medical community begins hearing that we have been under-prescribing opioids because of an overblown fear of addiction, and that we could be much more compassionate if we were to use opioids more liberally. And we didn't just hear this from the drug company, or we would have been less gullible. We were hearing it from pain specialists eminent in the field of pain medicine who were on speakers bureaus for the drug companies. We started hearing it from our hospitals, from the Joint Commission, which accredits hospitals. We started hearing it from our professional societies. Even state medical boards began, which are the state agencies that are supposed to protect the public from doctors who may practice aggressively or recklessly, state medical boards start telling doctors, we will not sanction you based on the doses or quantities, but we will sanction you for undertreatment of pain. So this was a brilliant multifaceted campaign. It was very effective, and as the prescribing went up, it led to where we are today.
And one more thing I want to touch on before we talk a little bit about incarceration. You know, has Medicaid bundled the prescription in treatment plan protocols and unbundling it as a treatment protocol and finding an alternative? Is that expensive? And is that hard to do?
It is expensive. We're dealing with a very expensive problem. The opioid addiction epidemic is having a devastating impact on the budget for counties and states. Not just because treating addiction can be expensive, but you know, infants who wind up in the hospital longer than they should have because of neonatal abstinence syndrome. They're getting treated for their dependence. Treating hepatitis C, which is common in injection drug users, is expensive. There are many different ways in which this is a problem that's very difficult for communities to pay for. Even there are communities where they can't even afford the coroner's fees or caskets because people are dying at such a high rate. So the whole problem is very expensive. One problem with Medicaid and commercial insurance is that in many cases they will pay for the first-line medicine for treating opioid addiction. So the patients who are lucky enough to find a prescriber to treat them with that medicine, they can get the medicine paid for. But in many cases they can't find a doctor who will take Medicaid or commercial insurance for the visit. So they have to pay out of pocket for the visit to the doctor, and they just use their insurance for the medicine. Many state-licensed drug and alcohol treatment programs are the places where people with Medicaid would get addiction treatment, and very few of those programs are offering the first-line treatments. Many of them consider themselves abstinence-based, and they're generally staffed with drug counselors, and you know, they really don't operate like healthcare delivery organizations. They function more like social services agencies. So that's why I said we have to really build out a system that doesn't exist yet.
What did the commission say about law enforcement tactics and incarceration in addressing the opioid crisis?
I think the commission was pretty good there, and it wasn't just this commission, But, you know, even conservative Republican politicians, when they talk about our opioid addiction epidemic, many of them begin by saying we can't arrest our way out of this problem. We have to see that people who are addicted have access to effective treatment. This is something you're hearing a lot now. You didn't hear it so much during the previous addiction epidemics that disproportionately hit low-income African-American communities during the crack cocaine epidemic of the late 80s. We didn't hear policymakers saying we can't arrest our way out of this. And similarly, in the heroin epidemic of the 1970s, the message we got from policymakers was that we could potentially arrest our way out of the problem, and we got a war on drugs, a crackdown on crime, which all contributed to mass incarceration. So I think that is beginning to change now.
Let's go. Thank you, Sharon, by the way, for your call. Let's go next to David in North Freedom. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment. I've got a complicated mouth. I've had a lot of oral surgeries. One involved an extraction where they actually had to grind away bone. And while I was sore afterward, I really didn't have pain. I think a major problem is our healthcare system in general. People come in with chronic pain or pain of a sort, and doctors don't have the time to really listen and try to figure out what's going on. And so pain meds get prescribed. I think there's also a lack of education by doctors to their patients. Just because you have trauma doesn't mean you have pain. I'm a retired physical therapist, and one of the things that come out is that pain is actually a warning system, and you can have trauma without pain. Shark bite victims typically don't have pain. It has nothing to do with being in shock. It's that the situation is not sufficient to cause pain until later. And a paper cut is extremely painful, and yet it's not serious. And I think doctors just automatically presume people after surgery, after 4 or 5 days, are going to have pain, and it doesn't happen, and people take it proactively.
David, thank you so much for calling in with those comments. What about the role of dentists and oral surgeons in all of this?
Yeah, I appreciate David's comments, too. I think he was spot on. Dentists are a very big part of the problem. Dentists and oral surgeons are the number one prescribers of opioids to adolescents. And that's especially important because adolescents, before your brain is fully matured, you're at a greater risk of becoming addicted when exposed to an addictive drug. And one of the most common reasons dentists and oral surgeons are prescribing opioids to adolescents is for molar extraction, basically wisdom teeth removal. And what's interesting is that the evidence is clear that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, drugs in the same class as Advil, ibuprofen, is better for routine wisdom teeth removal than opioids because it has it's anti-inflammatory, it's an effective analgesic. And so the evidence is that if you give a teenager who's had his or her wisdom teeth out Advil, that they're going to get better pain relief with fewer side effects. And yet, dentists and oral surgeons are routinely prescribing opioids. And so that really is a practice that has to change.
Well, thanks for that call. Let's now go to Saeed in Green Bay. Hi, Saeed. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I am concerned that this pendulum is swinging a little bit to the other side. And it's important to remember how this iatro epidemic came to be. And it was not necessarily a pharmaceutical industry driven fact, although I can see how they flame the fuel. But we began to define pain as the fifth vital sign. And already by late 80s and early 90s, chronic narcotic contract as a means of treating patients who had chronic pain and could not function was already a standard of practice, and now, with the necessary interventions and making opioid prescriptions more difficult for physicians, I am concerned that there are patients with chronic pain which we are ignoring. For example, the death from complications of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, suicide amongst patients with chronic pain because they can't get their pain treated, and already there's been a couple of cases of patients showing up in physicians' offices with weapons and causing violence. I support the efforts that your speaker is standing behind, but I just want to ring the bell of warning.
Yeah. Okay. And, yeah, Dr. Kolodny, let's get you to weigh in here.
Sure. I think I appreciate the opportunity that these questions were asked so that I would have an opportunity to respond, because I think there are many people out there who believe that the pendulum is swinging too far in the direction of under-prescribing. I think people who may think that haven't really looked at the data, because our levels of consumption, of opioid consumption today, are still much higher than any place else in the world. We're about double Canada, which is the second highest in the world. The caller, I think, has a misunderstanding that I'll explain. The Pain is the Fifth Vital Sign campaign, that did play an important role, but that was not separate from the pharmaceutical industry. That was a campaign that began the year that OxyContin was approved, and it was a campaign, Pain is the Fifth Vital Sign, that was underwritten by opioid manufacturers. In the 80s and 90s, before we had our epidemic of opioid addiction, before the prescribing had started to go up, there was a movement to try and improve care for people who suffer with chronic intractable pain. And there was some very good advocacy for multidisciplinary pain care programs to help people who suffer with chronic pain. And the leading pain experts in the country were among the biggest critics of using opioids for chronic pain. The leading pain centers then and today were opposed to using opioids for chronic pain, and were places where people with chronic pain would go to be tapered off of opioids. And something that's interesting is that when you take a chronic pain patient who's been on opioids for a long time, when you taper them off, it's very difficult to do, because as you're coming down, the pain is worse temporarily. But once you get people off of their opioids, often their pain symptoms improve dramatically and their function and quality of life improves, because opioids are actually not good drugs for chronic pain. Opioids, it's not simply that they're highly addictive or that you become tolerant to the pain-relieving effects, so that you have to keep taking higher and higher doses in order to get pain relief, and as the doses get higher, your function may begin to decline. The other problem with opioids is that they're just not effective when taken long-term. They can even make pain worse. So studies of patients who are on opioids for chronic pain tell us that the vast majority of them are not doing well. They continue to suffer from significant pain and dysfunction, and often have a decrease in their quality of life. So these are not good drugs for chronic pain.
An opioid epidemic is devastating parts of this country. President Trump has declared it a public health emergency. Last year, overdoses killed some 64,000 people. It's being compared to the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s and 90s. Dr. Andrew Kolodny is with us. He's co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. He's also executive director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. Your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What should America do to curb the devastating effects of opioid abuse? Is this a government problem? Is this a state issue? Or should it be the federal government to take it on? 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a moment. Law enforcement in Wisconsin can now charge people who manufacture and deal variations of the opioid fentanyl. Governor Scott Walker signed a new law on Friday outlining all variations of fentanyl, an opioid pain medication that's stronger and more lethal than heroin. We're discussing the opioid crisis and the final report of the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis, which details 56 recommendations. Getting your thoughts on, well, has your life been touched by this addiction? 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Andrew Kolodny with us. He's co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Lots of calls on this, Dr. Kolodny. Let's go next to Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
I know three or four people who've died from the overdosing. One of the things about this, if marijuana was decriminalized in our state, we could study it at the schools. Dr. Zorb, a pastor, this weekend, he's on Wisconsin Public Radio. He was saying you can't even study marijuana because it is classed as a Class A drug along with heroin. And a lot of the people who have marijuana in their blood system, they go into the, and they can't get their meds, so they go into heroin and those other drugs. And one thing about marijuana, you cannot cut it with something else. These things with the opioids and heroin, they can be cut with something that you really don't know what you're taking. With marijuana, if you were smoking it, you can't, there's no way of cutting it with something.
Okay, and Dr. Kolodny, what about medical marijuana in this discussion over opioids?
That's a good question. There's a heated debate about marijuana, recreational and medical marijuana. It's interesting because the pro-marijuana side will often argue that marijuana is the answer to the opioid crisis, and the anti-marijuana side will say that marijuana will make the opioid crisis worse because it's a gateway drug. And my own view is that it probably wouldn't hurt or help the opioid crisis. I will say that marijuana is probably not a gateway drug, and there's good evidence that marijuana use doesn't cause people to turn to heroin or harder drugs. I think the gateway argument really doesn't make much sense. And I would also say that marijuana or cannabis should probably be at a Schedule II drug, not a Schedule I drug. A Schedule I drug is the category that heroin is in, and it's the category for drugs that are the most addictive, most dangerous, and are considered to have no medical use whatsoever. That's Schedule I. I think it does make sense for marijuana to be in a Schedule II category, which would make it easier to research it, and would mean that it could be prescribed in some situations, but it would be controlled and regulated the way we would try to regulate other controlled drugs. What's interesting is that as states have moved ahead with medical marijuana laws and are basically putting it into a Schedule II or Schedule III for the state, whereas for the federal government, it's Schedule I, that leads to some serious problems and an inability to regulate it properly. For example, if you look at California's medical marijuana system, the whole thing is really a farce. You have people out on the boardwalk handing out cards to go into the medical marijuana clinic, and I think just about anybody who walks in with any complaint walks out with a medical marijuana card. So I think that it should be a Schedule II drug, and it should be properly regulated, but I don't believe that it will necessarily help or worsen the opioid epidemic.
Tom, thanks for the call. Let's go to Pat now in Brookfield. Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to tell the speaker my personal story. I'm 39 years old right now, starting at about the age of 32. My wife, who is a former college basketball player at UW-Stevens Point, started experiencing back and knee pain, very unusual for a person of that age. Went in, thought it was just going to be an arthroscopic, you know, surgery in the knee. Her entire joint was deteriorated. She ended up having to get a full knee transplant, a replacement. Subsequently, that knee replacement didn't work. She had to get two more knee replacements, one back surgery. We couldn't figure out what was going on, but we knew something was wrong. Finally, we went to Mayo for about a week, 3 years ago, you know, after all the surgeries were already done, and found out she's got a genetic condition called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which attacks all of your joints and connective tissues. Since then, she's been trying to be treated on some type of opioid regimen. She was on a walker. She has crutches. About 4 years ago, once we figured out what this was, she found an effective opioid regimen at Frederick here with the medical director. He was under her exact care. It worked perfectly for 4 years. She retired about a year and a half ago. And when I say it worked perfectly, it allowed her to get up out of bed and have a somewhat functional life. She tried chiropractic. She tried Reiki treatments. She tried all of the shots for years, the steroids, everything. So it wasn't for lack of trying, but they found a regimen that worked for her for 4 years so she could live a somewhat normal life. Up until a year ago when he retired, first thing that went in, the new doctor said, well, we're going to take you down on your opioids all the way down to a level that just wasn't going to do anything whatsoever.
What level?
What
level was she on, and what level did they want to bring her down
so
to?
She was on Dilaudid. She was on 10 pills of Dilaudid a day, and they wanted to take her down all the way down to 3 or 4. And the reasoning was because of the CDC guidelines. If you read the CDC guidelines, it's a joke. Their studies are just, they make no sense. And if you're a member of any type of chronic pain support group out there, these stories are happening all across the country, all across the state of Wisconsin. And here's what's going to happen. And I'm not a doctor, but here's what I'm telling you. For somebody who's living with this and hears from other people in this situation, these people are going to go to the streets. It's going to make the problem worse, or they're going to commit suicide. They're going to kill themselves.
What's
going to happen.
And let's get Dr. Kolodny in here. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, let me start by saying that the vast majority of people who are on chronic opioids, meaning that they take opioids every day around the clock, the vast majority don't have medical problems that which would explain the pain that they're having. So the vast majority of people who are on chronic opioids have conditions for which there's a clear medical consensus they shouldn't be getting opioids. Conditions like low back pain with a normal spine, fibromyalgia, and chronic headache. That's most of them. There are people who are on chronic opioids who have medical problems for which there is a clear etiology. You can see why they would be having severe pain. And I think for people like that, there is a role for opioids. I think the way in which opioids can be effective for people with chronic pain, particularly chronic pain problems that are prone to flare-ups, are if the opioids are taken on an intermittent basis on the really bad days. And on the not-so-bad days, the patient tries to get by with non-opioid medicine or non-pharmacologic approaches for the pain. The problem when someone's on opioids round the clock is that you pretty quickly become tolerant to the opioid, and in order to get pain relief, the dose has to keep going up. And what happens is that many patients wind up on very high doses that are very dangerous. And for many years during the height of the enthusiasm or campaign to increase opioid prescribing, doctors were being taught you should just keep going higher and higher on the dose, and that the way to respond to tolerance was to increase the dose. And we started to see that patients on the high doses were dying at very high rates, and it wasn't just overdose that's a problem, but there are other serious side effects that come from being on very high doses. The CDC released a guideline recommending that we avoid putting patients on long-term opioids, but for the patients who are on these high doses, that doctors try to get the doses down to a safer level. And they came up with a level of 90 milligram morphine equivalents and encouraged doctors to bring patients down to that level. I think that is an important intervention because the patients on the high doses were not doing well. But, you know, this is a very difficult problem.
Yeah, and as Pat said, people are going to the streets to get opioids in order to keep their doses. Are we seeing this?
Well, what we are seeing, and we have two groups of Americans who are opioid addicted, an older group and a younger group. The younger group are people mainly in their 20s and 30s, early 40s. They're becoming addicted to opioids that they used either medically or recreationally, or sometimes a combination of both, like wisdom teeth came out and then recreational use followed. The young group, when they become addicted, even though doctors and dentists are pretty comfortable giving young people lots of pills, doctors don't like to give young people a large quantity on a monthly basis. So the young group, when they get addicted, they pretty quickly wind up on the black market, and the pills are very expensive on the black market, so they often will switch to heroin. And in the past couple of years, in this younger group that had been using heroin, we've started to see deaths soaring because the heroin supply has become much more dangerous. Increasingly, it has fentanyl in it. The older group of Americans who are opioid addicted, people in their 40s up through their 80s, 90s, are people who are becoming addicted almost entirely through medical treatment.
Mm.
That older group, when they become addicted, generally does not have a hard time finding doctors who will continue them on a large quantity on a monthly basis. And we are now starting to see doctors lower the doses for patients who are on these dangerously high regimens.
And we're going to, Pat, we appreciate your personal story. As we wrap up here, Dr. Kolodny, what are you watching for? What is the next step in addressing this crisis?
Well, what we would want to see, and unfortunately we don't have very good surveillance of the problem, what we would want to see is that the incidence of opioid addiction is declining. The incidence would be the number of new people getting addicted each year. If some of our efforts are working, we should see less people getting addicted. And then, of course, if we are trending in that direction, we have to see that for the millions who are addicted, that they can access the most effective treatments. And what you really want, you know, someone who's opioid addicted, when they wake up in the morning, if they don't take an opioid pretty quickly, they will be feeling very sick.
And we have to stop it there. So sorry. Dr. Andrew Kolodny is the co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University, also executive director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. This Hour of the Morning Show was produced by Keely Baltina. Executive producer Michelle Johnson provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation is on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.